Malik, your host for Home Fires Radio Show. This morning we're going to talk about something that's really very difficult to talk about. I have in the studio with me this morning the Bereaved Parents Support Group, which consists the people in the studio with me are Mary Barron, Shelley Swift, Steve Smith, and Susan Blanchard. Susan is a social worker at Fairbanks Memorial Hospital, and in that sense is the health professional that works with the group. And the rest of my guests are all bereaved parents that have had a child die. Mary, you started this group, or it was principally your idea?
Well, I helped start it. I had a little girl, Miranda, born New Year's Day in 1984. She lived for 4 months in the hospital and died on May 5th. And I met Susan during the time Miranda was hospitalized when I moved into the hospital. And after Miranda's death, I suggested that I would like to help start a group to pass on some of the support I had received from the hospital staff, who were wonderful. And another couple, Chuck and Debbie Frady, had at the meantime gotten in touch with the hospital chaplain, asking the same sort of questions because they had been involved in a bereaved parents group outside. And it was that small group of people originally that got a formal group going. Before that, physicians would call me and ask me to talk to a parent whose child was born handicapped, as Miranda was, or who had died. But there was no regular ongoing group.
In preparing for this show, Steve sent me a book called The Bereaved Parent by Harriet Sarnoff Schiff, and I read that book. And one of the things that she says in a number of different contexts is that the support and sustenance that you get as a bereaved parent from other parents who have also lost a child through death is some of the most important emotional support that one can receive. I think that seems to be true because it's such a devastating loss that it puts you apart from other people, and the sense is, how can you possibly know how I feel if you haven't also lost a child? And so out of her experience, she says that even people that she didn't know very well, that the support that she got from other parents in the same position was really important. You all feel that way, or?
Most definitely. I learned in my experience that a lot of the guilt that I had, a lot of the questions that I had, almost every other parent in the group felt the same way and had gone through it. It was such a support to me to hear them say that we felt that same feeling that you feel in losing your child.
Yeah, I find it's real similar to other groups of people who've gone through some really significant experience, say Vietnam vets or say drug addicts, former drug addicts, and they get together and they're the only people, just as bereaved parents, really the only people that can talk to each other and understand. On one level we can understand, on another level it's so personal. I was talking to somebody a couple of weeks back about it, and I said, the only thing I can say is that I was a bereaved parent, that I understand completely what you're feeling, and I don't understand at all what you're feeling. Mm-hmm. Because we share something on the same level, all of us, but at the same time, it's such a personal thing that we all go through a very individualistic experience.
That's another point that she makes. It's apparently not infrequent that the death of a child can have devastating consequences for the marriage. Even marriages that had the appearance of being relatively healthy and calm in advance of the death. And she attributes that to the sort of solitary, the unavoidable solitary quality of bereavement. And the fact that in some ways you look to your mate to be some extra special comfort, and that person themselves is in such grief that they're incapable of giving it. Would you like to comment on?
Oh, we all grieve differently.
And at different times.
Mm-hmm. And in different ways, on different time schedules. And this is perhaps hardest for people who lose a child through a miscarriage or a stillbirth. where the father has had no physical contact with the child, whereas the mother has been very aware of that child all through the pregnancy. And then, whatever the age of the child, when they die, our society patterns us to respond to grief in different ways. And whatever the way you're grieving seems to you the only way to grieve, whether that's by coping and going to work or it's by staying home and refusing to leave the house. And inevitably you resent, you know, your partner for not doing it the same way. And it puts a tremendous strain on the relationship. One pediatrician told me that recent studies show that as many as 75% of marriages and partnerships break up after the death of a child.
So one really incredibly difficult to sustain loss after another.
Mm-hmm.
So one has to deal with more than the death of a child, which seems quite enough to deal with all by itself, but the unraveling of a life in many other respects, which I suppose again makes the bereaved parents support group even more important.
It becomes, we've had, there are some people that have come to the group and said, I come here because I can talk here, and I'm not allowed to talk at home. I'm not allowed to, mm-hmm. to feel sad at home. I'm not even allowed anymore to cry at home.
A lot of people feel that after a few months, a month or two, that the grieving should be over. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not. And so they come to our meeting so they can.
Before we continue on, for the benefit of our audience, let's tell them a little bit about how one gets in contact with the group. I know that you have written a letter that is handed to every parent who has a child die at Fairbanks Memorial. Is that
correct? And it should also go to parents who experienced miscarriage or stillbirth. Also, those people also have a very hard time because, again, they get a lot of comments like, it was for the best, it was just some tissue anyway, you never knew this baby, etc. And we're finding that those people are in a lot of hurt. And
you can have another one.
Right, you're young, you can have another one. So we try to hit those people too and give them some support. And the letter, yes, is either given by one of the social workers or by the staff to the parents.
And the letter says that you are available at any time, that you can be called as individuals, that anyone who has the need to come to the group does not have to speak, does not have to participate, does not have to be disclosing if they are not comfortable in doing that, that there's no time limit. This is a group for a parent who has lost a child 10 years ago or 15 years ago, and it's still an issue? Is that
as
well as
recent? We've had people come years after the death. And people often call and don't come. They'd rather talk to us on a one-to-one basis, so maybe they don't need any more support after a while. Our names and numbers of the core group are on that letter, and Crisis Line also has them. We're a referral service for them. Sometimes the OB nurses at the hospitals call us, or private pediatricians when one of their patients dies outside of the hospital. The coroner's office has the information because all SIDS deaths are reported to the coroner. And so we will do essentially what the people want. If they want to talk to us, fine. Sometimes someone will call me and they've had a miscarriage and they want to talk to someone who's experienced a miscarriage. I'll give them the number of a member of the group who's had a miscarriage and who's willing to talk about it. And they need a particular person at that point.
So it can be either one-on-one, relatively anonymous, just through phone, or you can, in fact, come to meetings or some meetings or one meeting, whatever you choose. Speaking of phones, I do want to encourage our audience to participate in this conversation and to feel free to call in and ask my guests any questions that you might have about this really difficult issue. And our phone number is 474-5044. And I really do encourage you to call in with your questions. Let's start with a hard one from the point of view of the rest of us who have not had a child die. What is the best way that we can be of comfort or service to our friends who have had a child die? Is there anything that we can do.
Just to be there when they need you, and to be ready to listen, because that's mostly what a parent needs, is to talk it out and to try not to be judgmental in any way. Just support.
No, you shouldn't have let her leave the house. It's not very helpful. okay. And just being there is very hard for you, for the people who have not lost children. Our society is afraid of death. And you will
especially
children's death, yeah, because our children live longer. We do everything. We protect them from everything. It doesn't matter if it's possible to protect them or not. We're supposed to. So other people just flee from it. I've had people literally run around corners to avoid talking to me when I first came back to work.
I thought I had the plague or something. Yeah. And I felt like I did in a way.
The death of a child is so unnatural.
So unnatural. It is the most unnatural thing. You die before your child. I mean... Isn't that the way it is?
It's supposed to occur in chronological order.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There is another part of this which I also don't understand, and that is somehow this intense feeling of waste, lost potential that comes up around the issue of a child's death, even as compared to a middle-aged person. At least they've had years, they've had experience, and I don't quite understand that phenomenon. But
it comes up as the anniversary
comes up
phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Every year, Miranda will have been a year May 5th, and so I now avoid year-old children if I can. Particularly, she was half Eskimo, and I find half Eskimo or Eskimo children particularly hard to be around. Because I'm looking at what she would have been like had she been normal, had she lived a year. And the year, there are sort of ones that people tell us are particularly hard. The year the child would have gone to school the first time. Mm-hmm. You don't want to see the school buses that year. The year the child would have gone into high school. So what you're doing is you start a fantasy child before they're born. And that fantasy child remains alive. And so every time you see it matched in reality, it's the pain comes back. Which is why, to go back to what Shelley was saying, you don't get over it in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Your child should have lived for 70 years, okay? So every time you match what should have been with what is, the grief is still there. And the healing is to accept that it's there, mm-hmm. not to try to get rid of it.
Because you have to
factor. And it will always be there, yeah. Yeah.
You have to factor in all your expectations for
sure.
that mm-hmm. child and your own hopes and wishes for that child, which is... sort of separate from death of adults.
Mm-hmm.
Is that one of the ways, do you think, that makes this special?
I guess I think that adults' lives were their own business, and so are their deaths. But our children's lives are, for such a long time, our business. We're supposed to be in charge. And that I think that script just keeps kind of running in your head like a film strip.
And like they always say, not my child, mm-hmm. not my child. And it's just really hard to get over that.
There are two parts of that. Do you feel jealous of other people who have healthy children when that occurs?
Yeah, I've gotten over it, but I was ready to punch out every pregnant woman in Safeway while Miranda was still alive on a respirator. and felt very jealous. I think I was very lucky. I knew Miranda was dying for a long time. She was never going to be normal, so I had time to work through that. And I had time to work through my feelings about other people's children. Susan here, who's become a close friend of mine, gave birth a few months ago. And I didn't have any problems with her pregnancy, except that I was just real glad it was over and Allison was fine.
Me too.
I'm pregnant now myself and due to deliver in about a month. And there's always some anxiety there. But that jealousy does last. And I still find that the children who look like Miranda are the ones I'm jealous of. I was at the Native Arts Festival, and some of my friends I hadn't seen came in from the bush. And I was like, I'll take that one. if they look like her, that's still, it's not reasonable, but it's there. And as long as I know it's there, I can deal with it.
The other thing we were talking, the other part of this that we were talking about before we went on the air was that I said, does it make a difference in terms of your feeling responsibility or guilt if the child dies of an accidental death, which involves all the what if questions, what if we hadn't been there, what if I hadn't allowed, what versus an illness which seems to be more out of your control. And the consensus in the studio seemed to be, no, it doesn't make a difference. You still feel responsible. Could we talk about that?
Well, you do, and that's part of it. You've got to learn to accept that that is just what happened and live with it. It was an accident. It is very hard to realize that, though. I still have great difficulty in not blaming myself for letting Mike go out on his bike and all of that, yes.
How old was your child when he died?
He was 11 and a half. So when we were talking about what ifs with your children, my child would have been 13 on April 12th. Yes, you go through a lot of... I knew him for 11 years, so I knew more of his potential. I missed more than anything for Mike what he would have had in life. Yeah.
And he was killed as a result of an accident?
Yes, he was riding his bike and a car hit him. Yeah.
I think you feel that sense of responsibility. Even in my case, we had a baby who was born with some genetic defects, and he lived about 3.5 weeks, but you still felt somehow... When I was going through, my wife and I were going through that, we felt we were responsible. Mm-hmm. There's something, what can we do? What should have we done? What can we do now, even when there was nothing we could do?
And that's how the rational mind accepts dealing with death. You're always looking for something, for some reason
some
that this reason. Happened.
An explanation.
And
control.
Yes, that's being a person. I mean, that's being human. Right, that's what we do.
Why did this happen?
Yeah.
Right. Where and there is no answer.
There is no answer. Or there is, depending on you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a...
For people who may have joined us in the middle of this conversation, I am speaking with the Bereaved Parent Support Group. In the studio with me are Shelley Swift and Mary Barron and Steve Smith and Susan Blanchard. And I continue to encourage you, if you're by a phone and have some questions, to call us at 474-5044. The blaming of self also comes down to blaming of others, and that's a very difficult one.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with that as two parents?
Who else can you blame?
Lots of people.
around, yeah. The usual targets, and they usually don't deserve it, are the medical personnel.
That's true.
I think every person who's come to the group would say both of those things,
mm-hmm.
that I am very angry and I know I have no reason to be very angry. But it's easy to say, well, they saved that kid. Why couldn't they save mine? And any small thing that you disagree with in the course of treatment can become enormous. Any parent whose child is ill for any length of time before they die is dealing with suddenly learning an entire new discipline.
And world.
The hierarchy, the rules, the information. I bet you didn't know room air is 21%.
Oxygen,
neither did I. Miranda thought it should be 25% oxygen, and unfortunately the planet comes at 21%, and this became a very important part of my life for 4 months. You have to learn a great deal very fast in order to grasp what you're being questioned about. You have to make decisions.
And you're in shock at this time, and this is all happening to you. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that's difficult, particularly for those of us who have a child who's in the hospital for any period of time, is
mm-hmm.
as a parent, suddenly you lose control.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly the child's in the hospital, yeah,
mm-hmm.
and all these medical personnel are rushing around doing things, and you're supposed to be the one that cares for this child and protects the child, and suddenly... you can be left just standing there feeling very helpless and feeling like you're not helping at all to contribute to the child.
But I have found that most of the people that we dealt with at the hospital were very supportive of that. They let me do whatever I wanted to do with my son.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think I had the same experience at Fairbanks Memorial, in that I ended up eventually knowing enough about Miranda's care because they were willing to teach me that I could take an 8 or 12-hour shift. And I couldn't give medications. I couldn't do things that by law cannot be done except by an RN. But I was taught sterile procedures. And so they gave me as much control over her care as I could take, as I was willing and able to take on. And that was very important, because otherwise she would have had a 4-month medical emergency. And as it was, she had a life.
We've mm-hmm. talked about that in the group a lot, about how the Fairbanks Hospital is one of the best hospitals to deal with people on a personal level.
Mm-hmm.
I think that becomes a special issue with children, because they very often can't understand in a word way what's happening to
mm-hmm.
them, and they really do need a parent they're so frightened, and in addition to the pain, that they really do need a parent there. And so your life becomes, I mean, any family member being in a hospital, of course, alters everyone's behavior patterns and life while that's going on. But for a parent, people have to take turns, and if you're a single parent, that can be very debilitating physically.
Mm-hmm. I just moved in. I started showing up at bath time, which was about 7:30, and I didn't leave until after we fed her. She had to be fed by tube. So what should have been supper time, sometime about 6:30 or 7. Now, parents are sort of awkward objects in a sick room. It meant that the hospital had to work around me, and they were very willing to do so. I mean, they were willing to do treatment on my lap, to show me how to do treatment, so they didn't have to be in the room all the time. Even though she was attached to monitors and had a nasty habit of stopping breathing 3 or 4 times a week, and they showed me how to start her again. And so I really was able to mother her, and I would not have been able to do that in most places.
No, they take much into concern your feelings as a parent, because they understand that you're going through a lot.
So if some of our audience ends up in a situation where they have a child in the hospital, you really encourage them to ask questions.
If that's what they want to do, if they don't want to ask questions, then you know that's okay too. But the people at the hospital are more than willing to be there for them.
Susan can tell you something about that.
Yeah. I was going to say I feel very lucky, because when I was getting into the death and dying issue and trying to prepare myself so that I would know what to do when I went in to see these people, I did a lot of reading and was very happy to find out that most of the trends that were supposed to be the best things to do for parents were things we were already doing. For example, again, with the stillborn, newborn, and miscarriage children, I was reading that you need to have memories, you need to encourage holding, you need to have encourage a name, encourage a funeral, etc., and went marching up to OB to, you know, give them my revelation, and they were already doing it. So I think that the hospital really does keep in touch with the best way to work with parents, and they really are encouraging to parents to provide, you know, help with the bath, come in and talk with the child, etc. So
we touched on that a little bit, but let's talk about that in some detail, the difference of you have a new book that you made reference to. What is the title?
Surviving Pregnancy Loss.
Surviving Pregnancy Loss. Let's talk about that issue a little bit. As I say, we have touched on it. The difference between losing a child during a pregnancy, miscarriage, or at birth. There are some special problems for those parents.
Mm-hmm. We've really, and we try to go in and see these people, and sometimes they get in and out on the weekend, and we can't do much about that except hope that the OB staff is supportive. But we try to go in and talk with these parents and explain the feelings that they're going to be feeling, the cycle of grief that they're going to be feeling, trying to encourage them that they have experienced a death of a child, that they were anticipating this child even if the child was only 12 weeks old. Maybe they didn't even feel the movement at that point. And we also try to encourage them to overlook some of their friends' comments, et cetera. You know, again, back to the, you didn't really know this child, it was all for the better, are you still upset, this has been 4 weeks ago, et cetera. So we really try to prepare them for that and let them know that people are uncomfortable and don't know what to say, and that's why they sometimes say the wrong things. And to not try to shut it down after 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and we give them some reading material, too, about what they can expect and what they might want to say to their other children. And we, again, try to encourage memories. We can give them, depending, again, on the circumstances, if there was, like, a fetal monitor tape, we can give them that. Depending on the age of the child or the fetus, we can maybe give footprints or fingerprints, take pictures and have them available to the parents if they want those. We encourage them to hold the child if that's at all possible, even after death. We encourage them to name the child. If they are interested in having a funeral, we encourage them to do that, because the more memories you can create with this child, the easier the grief is going to be in the long run. So
the message that's coming across there very strongly is that you really have a right to your grief.
Absolutely.
And that you, on top of everything else, should not feel guilty that you're behaving inappropriately. Mm-hmm. Whatever you feel inside you is a legitimate feeling,
mm-hmm.
and you need to be convinced that you do have a right to that. Steve, could you speak to that subject a bit? Because your baby did die quite young, 3.5 weeks. Did you feel some special pressure that your involvement in the bereavement was...
There was some of that. I know my mother-in-law was up here. She came up when the baby became very ill, and right after the death, she said, "Well, you want to go ahead and have another child right away," which is kind of the attitude of, "This one didn't work out, but we'll pop another one in the oven and
as if it's replaceable,
And we didn't have a miscarriage, and I felt real fortunate that we had 3.5 weeks to interact with David and get to know him. But my feeling since coming to the group and talking with people is that a miscarriage or a stillbirth is just as much having a child, mm-hmm. As what anyone else would experience. And many times people who have a miscarriage or a stillbirth or the baby dies shortly after birth, they come and they feel kind of out of place, and they feel like maybe I shouldn't come to this group because I didn't. You know, somebody like Shelley had a child for 11 years.
They do. They really do. And I really feel sorry for them because they do feel out of place there. But they have this great loss in them and they want to talk to somebody.
It's the same kind of grief for anyone.
That seems like a real inconsistency. On the one hand, we would give you extraordinary support for the loss of an 11-year-old child and yet minimize the loss of a 3-month-old or a child that died before birth.
Or a child that's handicapped. Mm-hmm. We expect children to be healthy, and then we give people sort of brownie points for how many years they raise them as healthy children. And I know Miranda was born nearly brain dead. She was not. Her neurological system came on a little bit. But I remember a hospital... sent someone up to talk to me, and this woman came into my room about 4 or 5 days after I'd given birth, when we knew that Miranda was severely damaged and would be, but I was just really glad she was alive at that point. And she said, "Well, are you going to get pregnant again?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. It's a little early." And she said, "Well, it's natural to try to replace what's lost, isn't it?"
Ooh.
And I said, "My child's alive. Now, she may not be the child you want, but she's my daughter." And she just left. But that kind of attitude, that it's not the child, that the person you're talking to, your mother-in-law, your mm-hmm. sister, your colleague at work, it's not the child that they would have wanted. And therefore, they try to sort of disappear that child mm-hmm. and just urge you to start again. And next time, you'll have a kid that they can enjoy bringing presents to.
That they can accept.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah, exactly.
That the loss is less because the child has some limitations mm-hmm. or handicaps.
It doesn't fit their storybook image of a child.
Yeah, I think... One of the problems that I see is just the general attitude of and it's become very popular now with babies, I guess, in the last few years. I keep reading articles about there's a resurgence in the birth rate and things, and people are wanting to go back and have babies later on. But that everything we see and everything we read is all about rosy-cheeked, young, healthy babies and how wonderful it is and how perfect it is, and they're in umpteen TV commercials.
Mm-hmm.
They throw a cute little baby in there and we'll be able to sell a product. Mm-hmm. And everybody's oriented towards this healthy, cute,
perfect
mm-hmm. baby, and everything's perfect. And there's hardly any discussion about it may not be perfect. And in fact, it may not even live. And then when that happens, I think that's when people have a very difficult time dealing with it, because just nobody wants to talk about it. Nobody wants mm-hmm. to recognize
to think about
that may happen, yeah.
Mm-hmm. We have some very unrealistic expectations based in part on these wonderful mm-hmm. scientific, medical mm-hmm. breakthroughs. I spent a little time in Africa, and at that time the infant mortality was that 3 out of 5 children died before the age of 5, and they had some ceremonies that they did not go through with the child until the child was 5, and I suppose those were cultural ways of acknowledging that you don't necessarily get to see, to live to maturity, all the children that you bear,
mm-hmm.
but it was an expectation. Here we have an expectation that medical science is so all-powerful that it doesn't that mm-hmm. anything can be fixed.
You're mm-hmm. raising a really important question, because many of the parents who come to the group are suffering a double loss. They were so sure that their child was healthy and perfect and that medical technology could raise that child for them that they've had some kind of permanent sterilization procedure. This was the last baby they wanted. Mm-hmm. So particularly if the mom is delivered by cesarean section, she may have had a tubal ligation at the time of birth. And then the child is diagnosed as having a terminal disease 2 weeks after birth, or dies of SIDS at 5 months. And so we really encourage people to think very carefully before they have themselves permanently sterilized about what if in 2 years. Mm-hmm. We are too used to relying on the technology.
And not in the sense that that child is replaceable, mm-hmm. but
no.
in the sense that
you might want another
to continue your family.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And back to the issue on miscarriages and stillborn, I just wanted everybody to know that we at bereaved parents really understand what you're going through. We mm-hmm. really can relate to you, but they come and they feel really outside it.
I can see another benefit of the group. Two parents may feel differently about, well, especially as Mary pointed out, when the child is stillborn or there's a miscarriage, mm-hmm. the father may not, in fact, have really identified with that child yet, and so the grieving styles may be very mm-hmm. Different. Obviously, Steve had a real strong bond with the baby, but that's not always true of new fathers, and so in that way, your group may be real supportive of the parent who has a strong need to mourn and to grieve when the other parent may not feel so strongly.
We may be also able to help the parent who doesn't, because we can give Steve's name or the name of other fathers to fathers who are exasperated. They may call up. I've had calls like this and say, "My wife won't stop crying. What can I do?" And sometimes they can talk to another man who says, "Yeah, I also don't want to cry in public," and so on. But maybe, you know, maybe you're still sad. Maybe it would help if we talked about the fact that we did hope to teach this child how to play baseball. Okay, so that it's not that either style is wrong. Okay, keeping it in and going on as if nothing had happened is the way some people deal with it. And we can get them in touch with people also. They may not want to come to the group. That's fine.
Try to encourage in each other the tolerance for different mm-hmm. styles of mourning. Our phone number, again, is 474-5044. The fact that we're not getting calls may be a measure of how difficult this topic is to discuss rather than lack of interest. But if you do have a question or if you have some thoughts that you'd like to share with us, I do encourage you to call 474-5044. And again, I am talking to members of the Bereaved Parents Support Group, Steve Smith, Susan Blanchard, Shelley Swift, and Mary Barron. And we do have a call. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to ask a question. I've never had a child that died, but wanted to know about what you do when people you know have children that have died. That what do you do with your own kids? I mean, I know you can't hide them, but on the other hand, mm-hmm. a parent is naturally proud of their children, and they want to sort of show them off to the world, but sometimes I know you feel funny, you know, saying, "Well, look at my kid, you know, isn't he great," and everything, and you know that this person, their kid has just died, and how do you deal with that? I mean, should you, or hang up. And
that's an interesting question. You know, does your relationship have to change with the bereaved parents so that you never ever after discuss your own children, when perhaps that has been one of the main contexts of your friendship, is sharing child care concerns and so on, too?
Well, I agree, and I had run into a lot of problems with that with my friends. They just stayed away. They didn't want to bring their children over. I had one lady bring her three little boys over, and one of them come in and goes, "Where's Mike's ghost?" And she just went into hysterics almost, and she was crying and apologizing. But I understood completely. That little child didn't know any different. And for her to get so upset and then not come back made it mm-hmm. worse for me. You want your life to go on as normally as possible, and I still have feelings for those children. So, Yes, we want to hear about it, and I'm sure your friend would want to hear about your child. And if not, they would let you know.
I guess the thing I hear you saying is to be sensitive and maybe to get up the courage and just say to your friend, I want to talk about my children if you want to hear it. I want to talk about your dead child if you want to talk about him or her. I want to do what's best for you. And I guess we put a lot of burden on the grieving parent to be the norm setter and to break
ideal.
The ice.
That's mm-hmm. ideal. Then the grieving parent can just say what they want to. And
after
say,
a time.
I don't want to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think after a time they're ready to do that. In the beginning they don't even know what they're doing.
Numbness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think I've experienced, and I know we've talked about Mary and you've had it, and I think probably you've had it too, Shelley, but lots of times we've found that when we talk with people, maybe the first time after we've seen them after the death of the child, we suddenly discover we're being the strong one supporting them, and they suddenly feel very uncomfortable, or the question may come up with just a new acquaintance, do you have any children? And you say, well, I don't have any living children, and suddenly there's kind of...
End of conversation.
You know, and you have to be supporting them. One thing I wanted to kind of bring out, because we've been talking about how the grieving process continues and it doesn't end, and is that in spite of that, we're not just emotional cripples because we've had the death of a child. I mean, we go along and we're very normal and laughing and yeah.
In fact, I think life becomes much more precious and we become much more, is the word I want?
I'm
much
not
more into
it.
Life than we were before. It's very short, and we realize that.
Yeah, for the woman that called, my wife and I now don't feel at all bad about being around other children or friends who have children, and in fact, look forward to that. I mean, all of us are very interested in children, which is how we kind of became bereaved parents.
That's how we started. Yeah, I feel the same way. Don't feel embarrassed, because children will inevitably say things that are not what you would expect or want them to say. I've had small children walk into the house and say, are you the lady whose baby died? And I'll say, yes. And they'll say, you got any pictures? And I'll show them some pictures. And that's okay. I'd much rather, and I think any parent, rather deal with that than deal with people who just disappear your child and can't take
can't
it if you mention
their
name or...
Mm-hmm.
Don't feel apologetic. That's a much healthier attitude than what most of our society has.
I'm very good friends with Marshall Whiting and her husband, Bix, and their child. Bix Jr. died in a plane crash in December, and it seems much easier for me to talk about the adult Bix, and I am still grieving his death, but it's much more difficult for me to talk about little Bix. It's more difficult for Sam and I to bring up that subject, and I mentioned that to you before we went on the air. It's such a curious thing that it's so much harder for me to mention him, to talk about him.
And that's the way with people hearing about a child's death. It is so much harder for people to hear you talk about a child's death. They just don't want to be part of that. Yeah.
Plus, it's just a scary thing, especially if you are a parent. You think, gosh, my friend lost her child. I guess my child could die too. And
puts
none
it
of
right
us wants
to
think about that.
We've had.
But it's not contagious.
Right.
No,
no.
It's not. It is not contagious.
We've had parents in the group who've related stories about the fact that when it became known to other people that this parent had lost a child, the friends would not let the bereaved parent hold a baby, or didn't want that bereaved parent to be around while they were. The friend was going through a pregnancy for fear that somehow there was something contagious there.
Superstition connection, yes.
Okay. Actually, I have to relate something kind of funny. When I was pregnant, Mary gave me some of her maternity clothes to wear, and I had one friend say, oh, where'd you get all these maternity clothes? And I explained, and she said, do you think that's such a good idea?
Yeah.
And I sort of thought about it and decided that I probably...
Genetics are not catching.
That's right. But it is a feeling that...
Since we're talking a little bit about children, the thing that Harriet Sarnoff-Schiff says in The Bereaved Parent is one of the most difficult things is dealing with other children in the family, and apparently one of... the issues that many bereaved parents feel they handled poorest, I don't know how you can make judgments about handling things well or poorly in the circumstances. You just need to get through it. But they have regrets about the things they did or did not do for their children.
Shelly's going to probably answer that. She's got more kids than
Mike
other
was
children.
Mike was our oldest son, and I have three younger sons, so I've gone through all of it. I've gone through a reaction from a three-year-old to a six-year-old to BJ is 11 and almost 11 and a half now. It's just, I don't know, you just are there for them and try to help them understand as best that you can.
I think it's real.
You have difficulty raising your children anyways. With the death there, it's compounded. So
there's so many things that relate to that too, because you're going through your intense grief and they're going through grief, and it's like spouses, it's hard to relate to them.
Or see it, because
right?
With kids, they don't actually, all of them don't show you all the time what is happening to them.
And they can act it out in different ways, too, by acting out, for example. I think it's real important, though, for parents, and you folks probably know this better than I, to show your children that you're also very sad and not try to hide your emotions from the children and cry with them and say, you know, I miss Mike,
too. We still
too,
do
and,
that.
Mm-hmm.
We still do.
Wouldn't
conversation
nice,
always comes up about how much.
But also in that context, you need, children are so needy of your emotional support and sustenance normally, and when they have lost a sibling, when a sibling has died, their needs are greater, and I guess it takes some kind of Herculean emotional effort to give them that support, but that's what Harriet says. She realizes that her grief was so profound that in some ways she, on some level, she feels that she failed her other children.
Well, I do too. I mean, I wish that I could have been said more to them at times, and when I didn't realize that they were grieving. But you do what you can do.
And I guess saying that is some kind of comfort, that there isn't a perfect way to handle that. She had a four-year-old. Her daughter was 4 years old when her 10-year-old son died, and she felt that that was too young to go to the funeral. And psychologists agree that children have very poor difficult time understanding death before five, or at least that's what's said in the book. However, the daughter is very resentful to this day, some 10 years later, that she was not allowed to go to the funeral, and Harriet Schiff says, you know, I don't know what to say about that. We did the best we could at the time. We made a decision. She feels it was wrong, and I'm sorry about that. But
there are people who will help you with those decisions. We have had professionals come into the group regularly and speak, and Dr. Alan McFarlane, who's a pediatrician in town, came in and spoke about just this topic. But you can get help from the hospital staff, from private physicians, from Susan, other social workers. They can tell you what is and is not appropriate for another child of a certain age, how they feel about death. Children under about five, they don't understand it's permanent. We have one parent who said that her older child is convinced that her now dead infant brother lives in Chapel of the Chimes, and for some reason has moved there. And
Sky used to think that we'd drive by there, and he'd think that Mike was there, but I took Sky through all of it. I took him to the hospital. I took him to the funeral. We go to the graveyard, because as he's getting older, he was three when Mike died, but as he's getting older, he's able to put it all together and into a perspective for himself. I can see it just adding up in him. So I think it's better, my personal opinion, is to take your child through, no matter the age, because eventually it'll all go together for them.
A really complex task that you pointed out, that you have to deal with death on a whole variety of levels if you have children of different ages. You have to do the 3-year-old version of death and the 7-year-old version of death and the 8-year-old.
And the 11-year-old, which is the next in line, who probably feels the most guiltiest. I mean, even though statistics say the younger child was going to feel guilty, but I don't agree with that. I think the one that's closer in range has more comprehension of what happened and therefore feels a lot of guilt.
My daughter
wishing it was him instead.
Him instead, or that he had something to do with
or
it.
Or was, well,
absolutely, yeah.
Personally,
yeah, sure.
With my in my experience with my other son, he wishes he would have been there with him.
Sure.
I mean, you know, because they were always together.
And could somehow have prevented it or changed it.
Or
just
something, anything.
A sort of unfinished thought, not knowing what, but
just a...
Whereas
anything.
His younger brother thought if he would have taken his motorcycle, Mike wouldn't have gone on the road because the motorcycle wasn't on the road. I mean, they have all mm-hmm. their own, mm-hmm. which only compounds my older son's feeling, wishing he was involved.
Their own combination
yeah,
of things.
Yeah, so they all
things.
Go through all different sorts of...
And she pointed out in the book that very often the siblings will remember the fights to mm-hmm. to an exaggerated extent and forget about all the kindnesses and good times, but feel very bad that there was
bad
sibling
times.
Rivalry, which mm-hmm. is in yeah. fact just a part of life.
Mm. I have a 17-year-old daughter who's now 18. Was 17 when Miranda was born and died. And she doesn't live with me all the time. She's here in the summers. She's in school outside. She was up, and again, a compliment to the hospital. We did get permission for her to go into the intensive care nursery and hold Miranda and help feed her. And so she had some real contact with her sister. But she's going through a kind of almost adult grief, and, you know, that's really not her responsibility. But yet she's okay, and she's, you know, almost adult. And why should her sister have to die? And I'm seeing it in her anxiety about this pregnancy. You know, she just checks every time I have a test, which I do regularly. You know, I get a long-distance call. What are the results, Mom? And, you know, that anxiety level, which I'm sorry she has to bear, because I can tell her there's nothing she could have done, but mm-hmm. I know that she can't really integrate that.
But just as you had no control over mm-hmm. Miranda's death, you also don't have any control in sparing her mm-hmm. that grief and depression either.
The control over Miranda's death is something we talked about a little bit before that you might want to raise again, is that you do have some control over a child's death if it's not sudden in an accident, because all three of the parents here had to make decisions about exactly when to stop life support. And
how to stop
how
it.
To stop mm-hmm. it, and we were all present at the death of our child. And that's something that I think most people who have not experienced it ever think about. And it's something that bereaved parents want to talk about. Mm-hmm.
You feel?
And no one wants to hear. I had one mom call me up, and her child had died of SIDS. And she wanted to talk about what it felt like to pick that child up in the morning when he was dead. And she said on the phone, she said, "I'll never own a rubber doll again." And I said, "Oh, I know just what you mean." What she meant was, that's just what a dead baby feels like. And she burst into tears. She said, "I didn't think anyone would ever understand that."
Probably she didn't want to say it out loud to anyone else, but she needed to.
Yeah,
so.
It's not good,
it's good
shopping cart conversation. Yeah.
True.
So that there is, because of the technology again, parents are now put in a position of making decisions that they should never have to do,
no. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What can be done about that?
I don't think there's a lot that can be done about it. We don't want to stop technology, so mm-hmm. but we just have to learn to understand that this is something that has to happen and not to take it to blame on yourself.
Mm-hmm. And as neonatal surgery improves and increases, that presents many more choices that parents and potential mm-hmm. parents are going to have to make. Because the technology exists, does that mean that you are morally bound to use it?
That's it. We ended up, all three of us, at some point choosing our child's death as the best thing for the child. And that's something people just don't expect to have to face.
No, and I think that it's the parent that has to make that choice. I realized when everything was going on with David and things were getting worse, the doctors kept coming and saying, "Well, we have to start making some decisions." You begin to realize the real ultimate responsibility you have as a parent, that the care and that... that point, the actual life or death of that child was your responsibility. And I don't think it can be anybody else's. In fact, it turned out I wrote a nasty letter to NPR when they did the coverage of Baby Faye.
I agreed with it.
Because at one point on the program, they had all these, they were talking about who should make the choice on whether the child lives or dies. And they paraded on, I think it was All Things Considered, a bunch of experts who were all very knowledgeable, very well educated, and not one of them was a bereaved parent. And I think that, of course, you have to have all the information that's available medically, and you have to know what the options are, but the final responsibility has to be the parents. And it's a tough thing to call. And in the case of our child, at one point we made the decision, well, if he goes into cardiac arrest, we do not want you to use heroic measures, they call it, to save him.
Mm-hmm.
Then at another point, they said, okay, your baby's dying. We have to think about pulling him off. He's on a respirator and a lot of other things. And I could understand it logically, but I didn't feel yet in my heart I could say to pull him off. And we said, let's let him decide. And that was a very tough decision. And the hardest night in my life was to sit with David that night because his skin was breaking down. So it was just kind of a mass of blood underneath him. And he was having these spasms periodically. He was probably in a coma at that point. And to sit and to see that pain he was going through.
That's the ultimate.
Mm-hmm. Wanting to end that.
The suffering for
and
your child.
When should I end that? In our case, the next morning, David made his own choice and died, and we took him off the respirator about a half hour before he died. But if I'd had to sit through that maybe another day or two, I may have made the decision, all right, let's just pull off all mm-hmm. the support we have going with him there. That was a decision we made. I wouldn't argue with anybody else who was in circumstances who made the completely opposite decision, the parent, because that's the choice you have to make. That's up to you. That's your responsibility.
So the rest of us need to be cautioned that we are in error when we rush to make judgments about other people's choices. There was great public discussion, I remember, about Karen Quinlan, her parents' decision to take Karen off the respirator. And frequently also when children, as Mary mentioned, when they're severely brain damaged or handicapped, there's a real tendency on the part of many of us to say, hey, you know, that kid would be better off. Well, it's not my child. Mm-hmm. You know,
I had to go through a switch with that. I wanted Miranda to have her life as long as she could have it in reasonable comfort, although her life was essentially a coma. She did know some things. She appreciated being stroked and held. And I did not have to fight for that in this hospital. But clearly some people felt I had made the wrong decision when I fought to have her resuscitated. And, you know, when I would make decisions, I didn't have to fight. And they felt that her life was perhaps taking up more time and more skilled attention and more money than she deserved. And I felt that she was a person and she deserved it. And then, it's like what Steve is talking about, at the end she went into congestive heart failure. She couldn't clear her lungs. She had a tracheostomy. She had to be suctioned. We were having to suction her every minute or two. That's miserable for a child. And at that point, I felt that for her sake, she should no longer be resuscitated. It was too painful for her. And I think what people from outside don't often understand is the parent is often making the decision that goes against their wishes.
No, oh, yes. If we could have our wish, our babies would all be living up. My son would still be hooked up to whatever that would keep him there so I could go see him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd feel the same way about Miranda. But people don't see it that way.
You have to put yourself in a position as to what is the very best thing for Mike or for Miranda. Yeah, or David.
That's what you said, Shelley, before, is that in the end, I had to make a decision for Mike. What would be best for Mike?
Yeah.
And that is so difficult. Oh. I mean, even if it is a person who is of your own flesh and blood, and I guess that is the special connection here, because it is your own flesh and blood, this child that you've brought into the world and chosen. And so I think that's perhaps part of the reason that this is so difficult, because it's very hard to make that separation between yourself and that other person. Is that?
Yeah, and then that could be one of the difficulties afterwards, is always playing this game of second guessing.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Did I do the right thing? Should I have done something else?
Should I waited? Mm-hmm. Should I have waited? You know.
The way that my wife and I have dealt with it is just to say, well, we knew we had to make these decisions, and we made those decisions. We just don't look back now. We made what was the best decision at the time, and we can't, nothing we could do now will ever change that decision.
Right. The first question I asked after Miranda died, I held her for about 2 hours, and when the shift changed in the hospital, a nurse on pediatrics, whom I'd become very close to, came in as soon as she found Miranda had died, and Susan had already come and was with me. And the first thing I asked her was, she came in, gave me a box of Kleenex and a big hug, and I said, Katie, did I do the right thing? And she said, yes, you did the right thing for Miranda. And
for
after
Miranda.
That, I didn't need to ask the question anymore. But I needed to check it out with someone who wasn't there. I think that was important. Mm-hmm. But then I agree with Steve. At that point, if you're going to go on, you can stay in the grief forever completely. And that's not healthy. When we say grief continues, I mean, we're all doing things. We're working in this group. We have full-time jobs. Shelley's going to school full-time. You can use what you've learned, and you do learn from something like this.
Well, you do.
Either you grow or you break. You have no choice. Then
you become kind of selfish in life. You want
your
life to be whatever you can make it, and for your children, your other children, yes.
And that's a memorial to the child who's died.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like we're not going to let our lives deteriorate. We're going to make something of Mike's death, of Miranda's death, of David's death. Yeah.
That is one of the real gifts I believe that this group gives is a reassurance to parents who have just had a child die that there is life after this event.
It does get better.
you
can say
that
it doesn't go away, and it doesn't go away right away. And people will call up and say, "I'm behind a window. I feel like I'm drunk." That I'm in shock, and you say, "Yes, I know. It does get better." And they can believe that from someone else who's been through it.
Mm. That was one of the biggest helps for me to go there and listen to everybody. I'm going, wow, everybody feels like I felt. Yeah. Yes, it was such a support. You're going to tell them when we have new meetings?
You are.
I am. We have meetings coming up for bereaved parents. The next one is on May 3rd at 4 o'clock at the Health Center. Right, Steve?
Mm-hmm.
And then you want to tell them about the panel discussion?
On the May 21st, one of the big obstacles that
kind of
parents face is deciding to have another child. And should I have another child? And if it was genetic defects, should we adopt? Or should we not have any more children? And so on the 21st, we're going to have kind of a mini workshop. We're going to have a panel of people who have faced that decision or face it professionally and discuss those options and discuss what people can do. That's kind of the next big hurdle people have to face.
We're opening that one up to the whole community. Mm-hmm. I mean, to medical personnel and everybody. I think it'd be interesting to everybody.
Mm-hmm. This is a very easy group to find. I know that you do a lot of public service announcements on radio stations and so on, announcing that you're meeting. But the hospital and most of the other helping professionals in the community do frequent referrals to you. Mm-hmm. And so anyone who is listening to this program who forgets how to get in touch with you, it's pretty easy. You can just call the hospital and they will help
give you,
even if you've forgotten Mary Barron and Shelley Swift and Steve Smith and Susan Blanchard's names, just call the hospital. I guess the strongest message that you've given me is that there isn't a right way to feel, there isn't a right way to behave, and there isn't a wrong way.
There isn't a wrong way to feel.
You know, it's just, you know, you have to do what you can do at the time, both as a parent, as a spouse, as a parent of other children who are still living, and as a friend, that you need to look into your heart. And I guess we need tolerance for each other and for each other's mourning styles and for each other's emotional needs. Do you have something else that, if you can have one short thing to...
Just don't stay away.
Mm-hmm. Reach out.
Reach out to someone, that's all.
And that at any point, mourning is appropriate if that's what you feel in your heart.
Mm-hmm. Most definitely.
I thank you all very much for coming.
Well,
I hope
that...
For those of us who have difficulty communicating with each other and our friends on this subject, maybe this will be of some assistance. And thank you all for having this group available to people in Fairbanks. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. This has been Home Fires Radio Show. I'm your host, Patty Kostelic. The executive producer has been Carla Tonella. I hope you have a very nice weekend, and we'll be speaking to you next week.